Day 27 of the U.S.-Iran war continues to rage on. We continue to wonder, is ground troops going to be in the cards coming up just here and maybe even a few days from now? What will happen to it then? Or is there going to be a rabbit pulled out of the hat diplomatically? Is President Trump going to find some amazing way to get a diplomatic end to this? All this we're waiting to be discovered, possibly within days. However, I want to take a look today at how we got here. Because we have today with us a remarkable guest, a great opportunity, Joe Kent, former director of the National Counterterrorism Center, number two at the ODNI, who recently made a lot of international news by resigning. And now we're going to find out a little bit, you know, straight from the horse's mouth, what in the heck was going on. Joe, first of all, welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Danny, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, let's just jump right into it because, you know, a lot of people are wondering what led you to making the decision you did to resign? Because we've all read the letter. We actually did a show on it here the day that you made the announcement. And we've talked a lot about what you wrote in there. So we've seen a lot of that. But I just want to start off, first of all, with kind of your own personal journey. I just know from my own experience in 2012 of coming forward while I was still in uniform, about the lies that our leaders were telling us about the Afghanistan war and the death and destruction, the reality, et cetera. And that was an agonizing process for me. And I just wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what led you in the conflict between, I want to stay inside and serve, I want to keep helping, or do I make this move to come out and say what you did? Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, it was both. I would say my issues with the fact that the Israelis, as I pointed out in my letter, really forced our hand. And I have a major issue with a foreign country dictating the foreign policy, but especially whether or not we go to war, those types of decisions for our nation. We can get into the details of how I saw all that firsthand. But then also just, you know, bigger picture, being a veteran like yourself, and I spent a lot of time in Iraq in my service. And I was somewhere in my third deployment when I realized that, like, we had pretty much gotten lied to get us into that quagmire. And I remember being pretty frustrated with my seniors, but especially like the veterans of previous wars, in particular guys like Colin Powell, who served in Vietnam. They saw the firsthand quagmire. They saw the lies that got them into that war. And then they soldiered on. They stayed in the government, and they were in very, very powerful positions. And, you know, quite a few of them, Colin Powell most notably, like, they helped sell the war, and then they never really came clean, you know, about it. They definitely didn't do anything to stop it. And so I said to myself, like, you know, 20 plus years ago, if I'm ever in a position where this is happening to the next generation, I will speak out. And, you know, coming into this administration, I was under the impression that we were going to do everything we could to avoid more quagmires in the Middle East. Now, I'm also a realist, and I know that sometimes we do have to do targeted counterterrorism strikes, counterterrorism raids, those types of things. And I think there's a place for that. There's a place for intelligence operations, all those different things to defend our country, to eliminate threats. But getting into another regime change war was just not anything that I was going to be a part of. But then also, like I said, just watching firsthand at you know, a fairly senior level, the Israeli government come in and create that ecosystem that I described, the echo chamber of official engagements that basically circumvented the intelligence process, and then those same talking points being echoed by pro-Israel members of the media, of think tanks, the AIPAC lobby, et cetera, to drive us into this war. That was where I said, hey, look, I feel like the traditional channels that I would have as a, you know, Senate-confirmed presidential appointee, head of the National Counterterrorism Center, my ability to influence this any further, it's just simply being blocked. We're not being listened to whatsoever. The deputies process is dead. The NSC process is dead. In order for me to stay true to my morals, to remove myself from being part of a regime change war, but then also to call attention to really the Israeli influence factor of it all, I needed to leave the government. And it was a hard choice to make, as you know, from your own personal experience. But once I decided it was what I was going to do, you know, I felt a sense of clarity, and I still feel really clear. I still feel very clear headed, and like I did the right thing.
And I guess just kind of on a personal level, how hard was it to actually make the decision? Because again, from my own experience, I know once I came to that clarity in my mind that I no longer had a choice morally. I felt I was not able to keep my mouth closed. But man, to make that long walk, in my case, across the Pentagon to go and tell then a four-star general, you know, what was about to drop was a really heavy, long walk. How was that for you when you went and told, I don't know if it was Director Gabbard or some other official, but can you tell us a little bit about how that happened?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long 2 weeks. I was hoping that we were going to, even though we shouldn't have gotten into the war in the first place, I was hoping that we were going to quickly de-escalate it, and it was going to be a situation like we had with Midnight Hammer. And so we worked really diligently to attempt to provide options of a quick, you know, claim of victory and then just get us out of there. Once I realized that we weren't going to be able to do that, I made the decision that I had to leave, and it was challenging. I mean, I have as a presidential appointee, I had to resign directly to the president. But DNI Gabbard was my day-to-day boss with NCTC as part of ODNI. So I had a really hard, frank, candid discussion with DNI Gabbard. Obviously she wasn't pleased with the decision that I had made. But she heard me out. And then, you know, I requested to actually like be able to deliver my resignation to the president. I got to do it to the vice president, which I'm grateful for. I'm not a primary cabinet member, so by no means did I, you know, kind of rate being able to go in and speak directly with the president. So getting to speak with the vice president, I'm grateful for. Again, same thing. You know, he wasn't pleased that I was leaving, but at the same time, you know, he heard me out. And then I got a phone call later on in the day, you know, from the president. And so those were really difficult conversations. But again, I felt clear-headed in having them. And then same thing with the conversation, you know, with the president.
And to the extent that you feel appropriate, how did that conversation with the president go? What did he try to talk you out of it? Was he upset? Did he understand? I mean, how did he, what was that conversation like?
You know, he was, I would say he was pretty polite and professional, honestly. He was respectful of my service. That he said he disagreed with the decision. He understood that I had an issue with the way that I believed. And we can get into it. I think that the data supports this, that Israel forced our hands. Obviously he rejected that premises. But he was still respectful, you know, thanked me for being in the administration for the time that I was there. But overall, I think it was a positive conversation. I think we, you know, ended on as good of terms as you can in the circumstance. So yeah, it was fine.
Wow. Well, I got to say that surprises me a little bit, but I'm actually glad to hear that both from DNI Gabbard, the vice president, and the president. I mean, that's about as good as you could ask for under those mm-hmm. circumstances. So yeah, that's a positive thing, I think. But let's get into some of the stuff that may not be as positive, at least not from the United States perspective. And that's this issue with a foreign government putting lots of pressure on our own country to take action that leads to war. And now then the death of American troops and all kinds of other damage. Now, this letter here was drafted about this current conflict we have right now. But as you told us before we came on the air here, this has some of the seeds were predated in the 12-day war of last year. And can you walk us through a little bit what you saw there and what you found problematic in the sense of Israel trying to drive the show?
Yeah, so essentially from the time that President Trump came back into office in January of 2025, there was an effort by Israeli officials and again the pro-Israel media echo chamber and a lot of the powerful, you know, lobbyists and donors that are very pro-Israel to get President Trump on board with striking Iran, initially striking nuclear facilities. But the Israelis, whenever you would deal with them, to their credit, they're very upfront. I mean, they basically said that they thought that right now was the time for them to take down the Iranian regime. And from an Israeli perspective, I understand their thought process. They view Iran as an existential threat. Iran funds Hezbollah, funds Hamas, and they had just dealt serious blows to Hamas in Gaza, to Hezbollah in Lebanon. Assad had just fallen, so they had lost their support network up there in Syria. And so from an Israeli perspective, let's go for it. They're at the weakest point that they've ever been. Let's strike them. Now, from an American perspective, we know that the Israelis cannot take down a major country like Iran on their own. So they need us to saddle up a major commitment, which we're seeing right now. And so from an American perspective, we have to ask ourselves, is this in the vital national security interest of the United States? And to me, the answer was always no. Our regime change wars in the Middle East always end up being a major disaster. I feel like we have enough data on that from the last 20 plus years, you know, over 20 years at this point. And so I always really appreciated President Trump's foreign policy in his first administration, and especially with Iran, because I think with Iran, President Trump had done a great job of using decisive force and action against like Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mani Mohandas. He killed them when they harmed Americans, and then he utilized the tools of our national economic strength to leverage economic sanctions on Iran to further pressure them. But President Trump was very, very deliberate in his first administration to not take the bait. He knew at an instinctual level that getting sucked into another quagmire would be bad for America. But also, if your goal is to take down the Ayatollah, again, we've got 20 plus years of data on these regime change operations. If your goal is to take down the Ayatollah, the last thing you want to do is directly strike Iran in a way that threatens the regime, because then people who might not like the Ayatollah, they're going to rally around the flag. And this was always kind of the working assessment. But because President Trump had said his red line for Iran was no new nuclear weapons, or no nuclear weapons period, like Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. That's what President Trump said, you know, as a candidate. That's what he said as a president. That was his policy. That was his red line. Now, the Ayatollah, the former Ayatollah, had a fatwa that went into effect in 2004 that prevented Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. So in essence, you had the former Ayatollah and President Trump at a place where they could get to the negotiating table because they agreed on a starting premise. And so then everything else would be about enrichment levels and a lot of other details that seem like they could be worked out very easily. And so right away when Trump came in, he appointed Steve Witkoff to go start negotiations, and negotiations were well under the way. Now, because we understood what the Israeli strategic objective was, the negotiations were a major threat to the Israelis' goal, because they were in fear that President Trump was actually going to get a historic deal with the Iranians. So what the Israelis did was, in a very clever way, they moved President Trump's red line. They took a statement from 2018 that Mike Pompeo, when he was Secretary of State, had made, where he said Iran cannot have any enrichment whatsoever, which basically means they equated enrichment with having a nuclear weapon, which just isn't true. And so they took that talking point and they used it in their engagements with between Israeli officials and American officials to say no enrichment over and over again. Enrichment equals bomb. This needs to be your new red line. And they repeated it ad nauseum in the media, especially Fox News, which the president watches. And so this echo chamber around President Trump basically made him move his red line, unbeknownst, I believe, to him. And I'm sure he'll push back and say that's preposterous. Made him move the red line from no nuclear weapons to no enrichment. And that really short-circuited the negotiations. And then following the 12-day war and Midnight Hammer, we knew that even if Midnight Hammer was successful, and it was, it even took away the ability to enrich. So really, it took the enrichment argument off the table too. We knew the Israelis were going to come back to us and continue to pressure. And this time they said, oh, no, you missed some enrichment capabilities. The Iranians somehow are now once again 2 weeks away from a bomb, or whatever nonsense Lindsey Graham would spew. But then also they started adding on all these other stipulations, like no ballistic missiles, just things that were completely unreasonable for Iran, a country that wants to defend itself, would actually request as a starting point for a negotiation. So watching Israel maneuver in that way.
I want to ask about those. So maneuver with whom? Was it with Witkoff? Was he supposed to change it when he's talking to the Iranian side? Was it with President Trump? I mean, who's moving America's lines? I understand that Israel wants to move them, and we watch that in real time. But who moved this goalpost inside the administration?
I would say it was very effectively done through Israeli engagements, like with their defense and their intelligence officials, with our defense and intelligence officials, with diplomats, obviously Witkoff being one of them. But from my perspective, Witkoff always understood that he needed to talk about enrichment levels, ways enrichment could be monitored. He knew, because he was engaging consistently, again, this is from my perspective, with the Iranians, that the Iranians basically said, like, we're going to have some degree of enrichment. And so, again, prior to the 12-day war, they were moving towards, I believe, a deal. I personally believe that Steve Witkoff had a deal within sight leading up to the 12-day war, which is basically what triggered the 12-day war, in essence, is that the Israelis really, really wanted to force our hand. Now, President Trump didn't take the bait, and he said, fine, we'll take enrichment off the table by conducting Midnight Hammer and striking these three different nuclear sites. But it was really so that you had the official level engagement, and it was repetitive. So the Israelis obviously have a lot of access because we're very comfortable with the Israelis. They have a competent intelligence service. So I think there's a belief that we're getting a lot from them. And in some ways we are. Again, tactical level, like you know, is terrorist X and location Y? The Israelis are very good at that. And so we do benefit somewhat from that.
That's evident.
But for us not to say like, actually, okay, they're good at this one tactical thing, but we have a very strategic, we part ways strategically, especially on a big topic, like what to do with a major country like Iran. I felt like we were never honest with ourselves about that delineation. And then the media is powerful. It really is. I mean, you'd have the USIC saying one thing, and then the media and the official folks from Israel saying a completely different thing. And, you know, on your best day, the IC only gets a limited amount of attention from key policymakers, but they're living, they're dealing with key decision makers all day long. They're dealing with key Israeli officials constantly. They're dealing with the donors constantly. They're consuming the media, which is moving the narrative constantly.
That's a big red flag as it is right there. It should be the exact opposite. It should be a lot more time spent with the IC and, you know, marginal with the media, which is just speculating a bunch of stuff. That by itself is a real problem. I think that we should be listening to the IC, especially on these things that can be validated.
Yeah. And you know what? The IC, I think, was pretty consistent on whether or not Iran was moving towards a nuclear weapon enrichment levels. But, you know, historically, and I actually don't blame President Trump and a lot of his key advisors for this, there was skepticism of the IC because of things like Russiagate, because of COVID origins, because they had been like lied to and there was games that were played in the first Trump administration. So I know there's members of the IC right now who are like, well, they should have been listening to us. And I felt that way as a member of the IC. Yeah. But at the same time, like, it's like, okay, well, I do understand the skepticism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, so let me ask you about something on that, especially on the Midnight Hammer stuff, because a lot of open source reporting is suggesting, and I've seen this from Israeli American and even some Iranian sources that have said that President Trump had a deal with Iran. We're going to hit these sites here, but we're not going to go in. This is in 2025, but we're not going to go into a full scale war here. We're going to hit these things. And as long as you don't expand into hit anybody or kill any Americans in response, then it'll end there. And you can fire something into Qatar at this location, as long as it doesn't kill anybody. And then we'll call it a day. Can you tell us if that happened or not?
I'm not sure if it was a deal necessarily. That I don't know. I have no idea. If that was a deal that he made, then he made that, you know, confidentially and kept it that way. But what I do think actually is just as equally as possible is the Iranians did see that we were negotiating in good faith. And I think they understood that we really could drain the Israelis. I think they kind of understood that. And so they were really deliberate during the 12-day war. We had messaged like publicly, I think, to the Iranians, hey, this is the Israelis, this isn't us. And the Iranians didn't attack us during the 12-day war. And then after Midnight Hammer, as you pointed out, we hit the three sites with, you know, certain amount of bombs. The Iranians, like 24 hours later, they shot, you know, an equal number of rockets at an empty quadrant of one of our bases in Qatar. And after that, it was known. And the Iranian negotiators communicated this and just said, okay, we're good, we're done. So again, when people make this argument, I was on Newsmax last night and they were saying, hey, the Iranian regime, like these guys are all like pushing for the end times. They're not rational actors and they're kind of crazy. And I'm like, look, I get it. Like I fought against, you know, jihadis and religious fanatics in the Middle East, and not all of them are rational. However, if you just look at the way that the Iranians over the last year have used the escalatory ladder, it shows that they actually are very rational. And so do their behavior at the end of the 12-day war and at the end of Midnight Hammer. And so once again, even though the Iranians were skeptical and we had killed a lot of the Iranian leadership, or not we, the Israelis had killed a lot of the Iranian leadership, they were eager to get back to the negotiating table this summer and this fall.
Now, okay, so let's jump up to this current situation here. Now then, the operative things seem to be, now this is according to, I think it was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, said that he received the order to go, the irreversible order to go on, I want to say 3:30 p.m. on the Friday before the strike. So that would be the 27th of February before it then struck the next day. According to what Steve Witkoff has said and according to what the Omani foreign minister said right around that same time, was it the previous day on Thursday with Steve Witkoff, that the Iranian side had agreed to zero enrichment, that they would put on the table long-range missiles and support for the proxies, which they had heretofore not done that. And they said they would do let more inspectors in, all kinds of things, and incredible, which in my view would have been a profound diplomatic victory for President Trump. But then we still struck the next day anyway. Can you give any insight into why we didn't take that deal?
Unfortunately, I can't give you any insider knowledge because I just don't have it. That was probably between a very, very tight circle. But again, like we knew there was no imminent intelligence that said the Iranians were going to attack us. The only thing that we knew was imminent was that the Israelis were going to attack Iran. And I mean, to give some credibility to what you're saying, I think that makes sense because a major threat to what the Israelis wanted in terms of a strategic goal was a negotiated settlement, was an agreement, a deal being worked out between President Trump and the Iranians. That would short circuit the entire Israeli program. That would basically ruin all of their strategic gains. In their eyes, that would throw out all the progress they had made basically since October 7th. So this is existential to Israel. So if there was a deal on the horizon, or even the threat of a deal, even the rumor of a deal, you better believe the Israelis were going to go in there and they were going to strike Iran, because the Iranians knew they had withheld their fire in the 12-day war and after Midnight Hammer, but they knew the next time that us or the Israelis came after them, that it was going to be for regime change. And so they weren't going to hold their fire that time. We knew that was coming. And again, that speaks to, you know, Secretary Rubio's initial comments, the Speaker of the House's initial comments, even President Trump's initial comments that, like, okay, we hit them because we knew the Israelis were going to hit them, and then we knew they were going to hit us back. So we decided we had no other choice, which is insanity to me. But that's how we ended up in this round of conflict.
Okay, and so let's get to the absolute key part. This was part of your resignation letter, and it was also a central part of the hearing with DNI Gabbard here last week or so on the issue of an imminent threat. The United States senior officials keep saying, especially Rubio and and the advocates like General Keane and Lindsey Graham are just screaming, oh, it was an absolute imminent threat. In fact, Lindsey Graham literally screamed there was an imminent threat. But when that keep exchange there between Senator, I think, Ossoff, and DNI Gabbard, he said, look, according to your testimony, we destroyed their enrichment capacity, obliterated it in 2025, and that there was no intelligence now that said they had made any effort to rebuild it. Ergo, it's literally impossible for there to have been an imminent threat of a bomb in 2 weeks, as Witkoff also said subsequently. So that the question is, WTH, man, I mean, how do we go from a physical impossibility that there could have been an imminent nuclear threat to, yes, there's such an imminent threat, we're going to launch a war? How does that work?
I mean, the imminent threat was the Israelis attacking. So yeah, there was an imminent threat. It was from the Israelis. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I mean, we had no intelligence that indicated, and this is, basically what, again, Secretary Rubio came out and said right away, and so did other senior government officials. The imminent threat was coming from Israel attacking Iran. The idea, I mean, I've heard Lindsey Graham say this, but people, we just can't take Lindsey Graham seriously. Even before Midnight Hammer, the Iranians weren't on the cusp of making a nuclear bomb. I mean, DNI Gabbard testified this in her annual threat assessment in 25 and again in 26, that they just didn't have the capability to do so. And they most certainly didn't have the intent. I mean, people sometimes forget about intent versus capability in terms of Iranian enrichment capability to even sprint towards a bomb. Number one, they didn't have the intent because the fatwa that it held since 2004. So honestly, look, if the Iranians wanted to have a nuclear bomb, they would have had a nuclear bomb long before President Trump was even a presidential candidate. They just would have. Like, these are not, as we're seeing now, these are not dumb people. And they've also got a ton of resources. So they, even if they couldn't have like developed one on their own, which they could have just bought one from Pakistan or from North Korea or somebody else. Completely doable. Not a poor country at all. So we had no indication that they had the intent to make a bomb. And then in terms of capability, even when they still had whatever level of enriched uranium they had in the three sites, that was going to take months to years to actually put together into a weapon. And then you have to talk about delivery systems. So, and then after Midnight Hammer, it was obliterated. It was destroyed. I mean, could they like dig some out of the rubble? Yeah, but not in 2 weeks, probably not in 2 years. It's absurd.
That leads to a disturbing next question here. And one of the other things you mentioned in your resignation letter was that it was, if not co-conspirator is probably a strong word, that's mine, not yours. But the cooperation of U.S. media and other folks, I'll add in, Lindsey Graham being one of the key ones here. I mean, he is specifically telling a story that's just fiction. I mean, there's really no other kind of way to put it like that. And yet there's lots of people in the American media across the board that want to keep pushing that that was the case, that we had to do it, et cetera. And yet it's not hard to figure out, as you have just laid out here and you had before, that there was no imminent threat. Why then is American media and American politicians so eager to help a policy preference of another country?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question, right? I think it's twofold. I mean, it's probably more complicated than just this. The Israelis, I think like the Israeli lobby, AIPAC, and how much money the Israeli donors kick around, I think that's fairly well known. I mean, the vast majority of our congressional leaders, Senate leaders, like they're taking some form of money from pro-Israel groups. I know AIPAC will come back and say, like, we're not affiliated with Israel. These are Americans who support, you know, Israeli interests. Okay, fine. And look, I ran for Congress. I had to go ask all kinds of people for money. I'm glad I actually didn't win that race because it was, I'm glad it ended up in Congress for that reason. You need money. And so like these guys have money. And so you end up relying on them. And then same thing, presidential side. I mean, you can look at how much money Miriam Adelson gave to the Trump administration and other pro-Israel donors as well. And so that gives you a certain degree of access and influence. But another, I think, just really overlooked factor is just how comfortable we are with the Israelis, because a lot of them are dual citizens. They all sound very American. They speak very Western, very American. You don't feel like you're dealing with foreigners typically when you deal with the Israelis, by and large. And the Israelis are smart. They will throw a lot of the dual citizens as liaisons and give them jobs with America. I mean, they're smart. They're pursuing their objectives. And again, the Israelis are good at tactical level intelligence. The Mossad is very impressive as a special ops guy and a, you know, retired CIA guy as well. Like, they're good at what they do. And so they're able to make a very compelling case when it comes to giving us intelligence. And I think a lot of times, because we're so comfortable with the Israelis, we forget that a lot of the information and intelligence they're sharing with us is used to influence as well as inform us. And so we're led to believe that we have the exact same objectives with the Israelis. And there's sometimes where we do, again, like, is terrorist X and location Y? Us and the Israelis are probably going to be synced up on it, and they're willing to do some of the heavy lifting. Great. You know, take a bad guy off the battlefield. But on a big picture strategic issue like Iran, I don't think that we are ever honest with ourselves and had the hard question of like, what is the U.S. policy here? What's our strategic goal? How do we reach our strategic goal? And then factor in everything else that the Israelis want and are telling us into that equation. Instead, we kind of let the Israelis write the equation for us.
And that's obviously, you know, we have a lot of problem with that because it shouldn't make any difference. Israel can have its desires. No one says that they shouldn't, but we should have our priorities that's good for America and not good for somebody else at our harm. And that's my view here. And I just kind of like your view on that, that to me, I could just take one factor here and say why it's not. 13 Americans are dead. And last report I saw, 240 of various levels were wounded in action. All this, it could be a lot more than that by now. That's about 5 days old. Why have we sacrificed any Americans for something that is not in our national interests?
Exactly. And this was a big tipping factor for me as well, watching the coffins come back to Dover. That was another reason why I knew I had to leave and I couldn't be a part of this. But again, to your point, like, why is this in our vital national security interest? It's not. We still have yet to have a really clearly defined strategic objective. When you hear when the Pentagon attempts to articulate what our strategic objective is, you kind of hear this punch list of like things we want to bomb, like we want to take out the Iranian Navy, the ballistics, et cetera. And to me, I'm like, well, yeah, okay, those are like strategic weapon systems and strategic capabilities, but that's not a strategic intent. You're literally just saying the things that you're going to bomb, but we haven't said to create what effect. The Israelis, you know, again, not a fan of the Israelis in this circumstance or our relationship with the Israelis, they're pretty clear-eyed in their strategic objectives. Like, they know that they want to take down this entire regime, and they're willing to continue to bomb and kill anybody who's IRGC or Ayatollah clerical affiliated until they get an outcome that they want. And if it ends up being total chaos, the Israelis are completely and totally fine with that. They have a very high tolerance for there being a certain degree of chaos as long as it doesn't pose a direct threat to them. we don't have that high of a degree of tolerance for chaos. And again, we're not being honest with ourselves in this equation.
And let's move on to now. You talked about our objectives here. Whether we should have gotten into the war or not, we definitely, both of you and I agree, we should not have, but we are. So now then the question is, where are we going to go now? And what's going on? If there has been, especially among several of the senior administration officials who have been, I will argue, intentionally dishonest in about what they're saying about how this war started and anything else and what the reasons were, that seems to continue on here. And let's just look at the conduct of this war so far. So Admiral Cooper comes on periodically and gives a statistical update of all these things we're attacking. 10,000 targets have been attacked and all this ordnance have been dropped and we've destroyed all this kind of stuff, implying that we're succeeding because the casualty list on the Iranian side is growing and the destruction list is expanding, et cetera. But that's coming at a cost. Number one, what is that supposed to accomplish? What is the destruction supposed to politically accomplish in terms of a war aim? But then number two, what is it costing us? Because, I mean, just take a look at this right here. This is as of a few days ago. Over 11,000 munitions had been used during the war so far. And according to this research, shows the coalition forces have expended 11,294 munitions in the first 16 days at a cost of $26 billion. The conflict has settled into a grinding trial of attrition. That is so important. And the sustained pace continues to drain the coalition's most critical assets. Accordingly, our analysis has tracked that since day five and after, Iranian missile and drone attacks have averaged about 33 missile attacks and 94 drone attacks per day, respectively. Now, that gets at what one of the talking points we had at the beginning of this war, and everybody repeated it. You know, we have knocked 90% of their capabilities down, and so we are definitely winning. You can see by that 90%. But that's a deceptive figure because that was the initial salvo, which they already had pre-planned targets. Since that time, they have a sustained rate that's pretty consistent. In fact, it's been slightly tipping up the last time I saw the specific details there. And that's something that apparently, according to Iranian sources that I've talked to, who have access to the government thinking, they say they can sustain this rate of fire indefinitely. But Joe, we can't sustain our interceptors, especially THAAD and PAC-3s, that much longer. I don't even know the standoff weapons can go that long. We're in a time crunch. How do you see that?
I agree. I mean, we depleted a lot of these critical weapon systems over the last couple of years with the fight in Ukraine, the proxy war there. And I think what our enemies have learned, you know, probably going back before our era, going back to the Vietnam or really just post-World War II era, I think our enemies have learned that you can beat the Americans by simply not losing. I every time that Admiral Cooper or any of these guys get up and they talk about, not to their detriment, like they're doing what they're supposed to do. I'm not besmirching them, but anytime they get up and they give us a list of like how many bombs we've dropped and how many things we've blown up, I'm just like, man, you know, 20 years ago, like we were coming up with lists of like how many HVTs we detained or like how many insurgents we put in flex cuffs or how many guys bad guys we killed. And that just ground on for literally two decades. We made no progress. Like, look at Afghanistan, look at Iraq. It didn't have an effect. Even the times where we were like, man, we got these guys against the ropes. We just won Anbar. We kicked Al-Qaeda's ass, whatever. I mean, it didn't matter. They won by not losing. The Iranians have been watching this, obviously, like literally to their east and their west for the last 20 plus years. They've built up a conventional military capability that I know at the like IC level we are aware of, but again, I think decision makers, because a lot of them don't have military backgrounds and a lot of them don't have intel backgrounds, they thought of Iran as another Afghanistan, Iraq. Like they just thought, yeah, like this is going to be simple. We're going to dominate the skies. All of our conventional weapon systems are just going to obliterate anything these guys have. Whereas Iran has been very, very smart with their development of ballistics of all ranges, the drone technology and their ability to sense and defend their own airspace in key positions. I think, you know, there's times where their airspace looks really weak, but then they surprise us. So they've had a lot of time to prepare for this, and they've clearly prepared very well. And I think even if like things look a little bleak for them every now and again, they can win by simply not losing. And again, this kind of goes back to where I think the president got a little bit of false confidence was in January, when there was actual protesters out on the street that were protesting against the regime. They're protesting against the regime as a result of President Trump's economic policies, the sanctions had put, you know, had made bad economic conditions inside of Iran that the Iranian people were blaming on their regime. Ironically, they were blaming the, you know, their regime for sending so much money to fund their proxies and to fight this war in Gaza, et cetera. They wanted to lower the cost of living there, and they wanted more economic opportunity. So they were protesting against the regime there. And so I think a lot of what the Israelis did a very effective job of is saying like, hey, look, this place is primed to go down. If we just do some key strikes, these people that are out on the streets right now, they're going to overthrow their government. And again, it that kind of threw out the window just a basic understanding of human nature, that if an outsider comes in and attacks, there'll be a rally around the flag. But that was also the assessment that most of us were putting out from the IC as well. So I think that's how we kind of fought ourselves into this. It's going to be quick. It's going to be easy. Our military hardware, it's going to knock down all the defenses. We're going to dominate everything. And this is just a silly little country like Iraq or like Afghanistan, and we're going to kick their butts. And it turned out like Iraq and Afghanistan weren't silly little countries either. They kind of handed us our lunch because they won by not losing. Iran, obviously, it's always been a thing. Persia has always been a major empire. They're smart people. They've had a long time to look and assess and study this war. The regime is stronger now. We've killed a lot of the moderates. Now the hardliners are going to take over, unfortunately. And we're going to be in this quagmire unless we take deliberate action.
And you say, unless we take, I mean, what, at this point, what deliberate action could we take that could change the dynamics?
Restraining the Israelis. Every single time that President look, every time President Trump talks about we need to de-escalate, you see the Israelis come back in and say, cool story. And they start bombing energy infrastructure. They start taking out more Iranian leadership. Every time Trump says, like, we're going to get to the negotiating table, we're going to give you guys 5 days to sort this things out. And people can say, like, oh, that's just for the markets or whatever. Fine, so be it. He still is somewhat offering a space where negotiations could take place. And who is that a threat to? That is a threat to the Israeli strategic objective. So we see the Israelis then double and triple down on their strikes in order to short circuit those negotiations. There was just a report today. I don't know if it's true. I read in the news, just like everybody else did, that there was an Iranian, there was a Israeli plot to kill the Iranian diplomat Arachi, because Arachi is one of the key communicators in negotiations. So look, I mean, even President Trump came out and said a couple of days ago when he was asked, like, who are you talking to in Iran? And President Trump said, I can't tell you because then they'll be killed. Well, they'll be killed by the Israelis. So if we want any kind of real progress made towards a negotiation or at least some sort of a temporary ceasefire, the Israelis have to be restrained. We have to say to the Israelis, like, you're done. We will help you with your defense if you're attacked, but if you go on the offense, all bets are off. We will pull away features of your defense system so that you literally don't have the hardware to go on the offense. All you can do is defense.
And let's just take a look at that, because the defense ain't that good anyway. This is a statistic here from, this is the Iranian missiles on Israel specifically. You see the sustained rate going. This is all the way through the 24th here. And you see it's pretty consistent here. And you've seen with Dimona and with Arad and Tel Aviv here in just the last few days, those missiles are getting through. That's right now. And so the question is, I mean, even for the Israeli side, and you're obviously not privy to their thinking, but just for your observation here, you can't sustain this forever. I mean, you can't get into a long war where you're taking this many missiles in the teeth every day. So what is the mentality on the Israeli side? Because surely, Joe, they've got to realize that militarily, this thing is not going to be won. You're not going to defeat them militarily.
Look, I think Bibi and the Likud party, they view this obviously as existential. They want the regime change. They are comfortable with chaos, but they also view harsh Iranian action against the Israeli people.
I'm sorry, you said that a couple of times. When you say the Israelis view this as existential, I certainly see why Iran does, but how is it existential for Israel?
From the Likud party perspective, I mean, this ties into the greater Israel plan and basically what they've been pushing for with U.S. foreign policy for the majority of our lifetime, right? I mean, this is why Netanyahu, as a young man, former prime minister at the time, was here in America advocating for the Iraq war. They wanted to take down Saddam. They wanted to take down Assad. Iran is one of the last chopping blocks. It's one of the major ones. So this is part of their strategic goal, to take away all their serious competitors inside the Middle East so they can take, you know, whatever land they want to take. They can have dominance. So it is strategic and existential for the Israelis, but in particular, I think the Likud party too. So the Likud party realizes that, you know, politically before October 7th, they weren't very popular. Bibi in particular was not very popular. But since the war has kicked off, there's been a rally around the flag factor inside of Israel. And you know, wartime presidents, especially if your country's under siege, they tend to be popular for this region, for this reason. And so I believe that the Israelis think that the more Iran rains down ballistic missiles on them, that's going to heighten American resolve, because we see, you know, this country that we have a very, very sentimental attachment to, a lot of Americans do anyways, seeing them under siege, so that's going to make us double and triple down, but then also rally around the flag around Bibi and around the Likud party. So I don't think the Israelis are as worried about that as we are. Now, I'm not an expert on the dynamics of what's taking place in Israel. I've seen there's some protests there. I've seen, obviously, there's some people who are frustrated with Bibi and the conduct of the war. But I think that's, again, their calculus, which is all the more reason why we need to restrain them. Because, look, we're paying for all of their defense. This is not a relationship that we should have with any country, but in particular, a country that owes its entire existence basically to us. I mean, maybe Israel would be able to defend itself, but they wouldn't be able to behave in the way that they do. They most certainly 100%. Wouldn't be able to go on the offense without America. Like, we're paying for that. So if President Trump's goal, and I believe it is to end this conflict, reopen the Straits of Hormuz, make sure we can balance out world energy prices. That means we need to have some sort of a ceasefire. We need negotiations. Step one of that, or it's all for naught, is restraining the Israelis.
Yeah, and I'm 100% in agreement with you on that, and we advocate that daily. Unfortunately, and I know we're running a little bit short on time here, we actually have another show coming up here shortly, but I don't want to let you go before you can answer this, because if we were moving in the direction of diplomacy and trying to put some restraint on Israel, I would be cheering with two thumbs up. But unfortunately, according to members of the House of Representatives, Republican members yesterday, there was a briefing from the White House that gives the indication that we're about to do something really bad on the ground, as Nancy May says here.
Was it the information that you were receiving or the lack of information that you were receiving?
It's
was
both.
A distinction?
I would say that it's both. And I would say that you saw Republicans across the spectrum today express their frustration. You saw Republicans and Democrats alike. I was not convinced when I walked out of there that troops on the ground were necessary to declare victory. But I have a hard time understanding what Karg Island has to do with some of our objectives.
Okay, somebody with 11 combat tours and fighting in this region, and now then having been, you know, in your intelligence community that you were, there's no military solution to this. God help us at all if we try on the ground, especially. Well, how do you see that possibility of taking Karg or anything else in the Strait with a handful of light fighters and Marines?
I like to look at things through my enemy's eyes. And so if I'm Iran right now, a gift would be having Marines and paratroopers descend or take the beaches of any one of these islands. I don't care which one it is. I would let them come in. And then I would make it very, very clear that but through the use of mining, through the use of ballistic missiles, through the use of drone swarms, they are now our hostages. So this would be a strategic disaster. Honestly, I think if the Iranians are smart, and they are smart, that they would let us take the island. They'd let us, like, you know, do a victory video about how now we control the refining and this is checkmate and the straits are open. And then I would just show them very, very quickly and strongly that they don't actually control the space. I'd use the drones, use the ballistics that we know that they have on hand, or even a more of a disaster is us committing troops to actually, like, the beaches, the land on the shores of the Straits of Hormuz inside of Iran. Because again, what they've learned for the last 20 plus years is that when we get sucked into these land engagements, all they have to do is win by not losing. We will eventually bleed out blood and treasure, and we will get sick of the equation, and we will simply leave. So this would be a golden gift to the Iranians, and I pray that President Trump is smart enough not to fall for this trap, regardless of who's in his ear. Nancy Mace and other representatives coming out, Republican representatives coming out and expressing their skepticism of this, that gives me some hope, because all these guys are on the ballot here come November, and they know they're going to hear from their voters on this issue. So I think people calling their senators and calling their congressmen in particular, because they're all on the ballot in November, and telling them that we do not support this, I think that's going to be crucial. Now, the president can still launch this as he's done for the last, you know, couple weeks now without congressional approval. But this is a little bit of leverage that the people have, is contacting your senators and your representatives. I just think we need to make our voices heard as loud as possible, especially the people who, like myself, supported President Trump and still want to support President Trump, like to know that this is a trap. This will get us sucked into another quagmire that will likely be worse than Iraq or Afghanistan.
And you know, Joe, this is something that's got a potential for a much worse trap. Because I mean, just take a look at this oil issue here. This is from CNBC a couple of days ago. I think it was. He said that it's going to be a real shortage. We're talking about the biggest supply disruption the world has ever seen. This is the biggest disruption, both 73 and 79 combined. The physical market is really going to bite some time in the next couple of weeks, is he saying there. And that is critical, because if you do anything on the ground, and some of my sources in the region say that something could come as soon as this weekend. I hope to God that doesn't happen, because until an order is given by the president, anything can just not be given an order. But the evidence shows that there's something coming up pretty soon. But that time clock is ticking. And if anybody thinks that that's going to cause some sort of a near term force to make the strait open up, I mean, I think you just articulated very beautifully, in a really bad way, it would make them dig in even deeper and make that strait even more shut off than before. But we don't have the luxury of time to get into a long war of attrition like you're talking about, because that price is going to just start eating alive. And my worry is, and some people have already speculated on this, that could then cause Trump to double down. And if that happens on the beaches anywhere that this goes on, and we start getting body counts, that people are going to say, well, we didn't go in with enough troops. You need to get some more out there quick. And just the question I have of you, how much danger do you think that the Israelis might say, yes, that's exactly what you got to do. Get deeper in.
100%. I mean, because look, if your goal is to topple the regime, you have to have boots on the ground. Israel's a tiny country. Israel could put their entire army on the ground. It wouldn't be significant. Israel needs us to do it. So I'm very confident that the Israelis are giving this advice right now and telling the president how easy it will be, how brilliant it will be, how bold it will be. And I really hope he listens to his instincts, because this is the president who 11 years ago called out Jeb Bush on the stage for the Iraq war. He understands. His gut instincts on this have always been correct. And so I implore Trump supporters to call their representatives, to respectfully contact, you know, the White House, social media, et cetera, and to say that, like, you're smarter than this. Don't do it. Don't take the bait. And as you pointed out, the stakes here are so high because of the Straits of Hormuz, because of world energy. There's only one solution, and that's diplomacy. And step one in diplomacy, like we just talked about, is restraining the Israelis. The Israelis need to be put back in a box. And then we need every single diplomatic effort to get some sort of an agreement with the Iranians that opens back up the flow of oil. And we're going to have to make some concessions, I think, like lifting sanctions. Nope. Iranian oil. There's going to have to be a lot that's done with the GCC countries, who we've lost a lot of leverage with, because the GCC countries have been attacked for housing our bases. And the reason why they housed our bases and used the petrodollar, because in theory, was that we provided security guarantees for them. Well, our security guarantees aren't looking so good right now when you're having attacks on, you know, the Doha International Airport. You're having attacks, I think, just this morning on the Kuwait City International Airport. So we're in a very bad way in terms of world energy flow, and then also our relationship with our allies. Again, and this won't be fixed by military. The military cannot fix these issues. You got to lean on diplomacy, restrain the Israelis, get to the table, get the straits open back up. That's our only way out of this.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And do you, I mean, you've been on the inside in the ways we haven't. Do you think there's any chance that President Trump would, because he's the only one that matters, would he ever actually put Israel in a timeout box, so to speak? I mean, do you think that's possible?
I think it is. I still think President Trump has a lot of agency. I still believe he's a strong-willed man. And also, one of Trump's like superpowers is that he can make really quick game-changing decisions. And so the Israelis may think that they've got his ear and they've got him right where he wants him, but it would be the most Trumpian thing ever for him to flip the table and to say, like, you know what? We tried this. Your guys' plan clearly isn't working. Look at the prices. Look at the effect it's having here on the price at the pump. I'm going to do something different. And through the sheer force of President Trump's personality and will, he can put the Israelis in the box. I think only he can do it, honestly. And then I think, honestly, he is one of the only people that can actually get a deal with the Iranians. I just pray that he tunes out the voices he's been hearing that got us into this war, listens to maybe some of the people who were excluded from this decision-making process, or really just go listen to basically the things that he was saying 10 years ago on the campaign trail, things he said just, you know, 2 years ago on the campaign trail as well. His instincts are usually correct. His instincts on wars in the Middle East have always been correct. His initial policy on Iran in the first Trump administration was correct. He needs to put the Israelis in a box, and all the advisors that got us to this point, he needs to just tune those guys out.
Exactly. Couldn't agree with you more. And what a great way to wrap this up. That's at least one level of at least some hope that President Trump can do that, because you're right. And I agree with him. Only President Trump can do that. He literally is the only one. We just have to pray that he does. Thanks so much for coming on today, Joe. It's been absolutely a delight to have you on. And we look forward to back having you back again soon, actually.
Absolutely, Dan. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. Thank you very much. And we appreciate you guys, too. We got a lot more for you here coming up just less than 10 minutes from now. We have the Durant's Alexander Mercurius live at 11 a.m. Who's going to look at some of this from some additional points of view in the European side and the Russian side. There's some involvement with that, too. This is a very large, complex issue with this Iran war, because it has international ramifications. Alexander is going to look at us with that here in just about 8 minutes. We'll see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.